Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at KSFR. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. The shows are archived there as well. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the Robert Frank Film Festival, and we're also going to be speaking to the two women dancing, plus a cellist. Right now, I would like to welcome Bill Hutchison. He's from the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. This is, of course, the first Wednesday of the month, so it's the day we talk about animals. And we're joined by Marguerite Wood of Small Dog Rescue of Santa Fe. Welcome.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you. And our wonderful veterinarian, Darren Llewellyn, has gone to Texas. And so we are inviting people from different animal organizations from around the Santa Fe area to join us.
And no, I still haven't gotten a postcard from him.
I haven't either.
Years of devoted service.
I know. And it's been 3 weeks.
I know. This is unacceptable.
He doesn't write. He doesn't call.
It's a call.
Marguerite Wood, tell us about Small Dog Rescue of Santa Fe. This is your little organization. How did you start it?
Well, it started because a lot of people in Santa Fe want small dogs, and we didn't get many here through our shelters. I've been a volunteer at the shelter for many years, and that's where I knew Bill. And I'd done some rescue with dogs and knew around the state that there were many little dogs wanting homes and not having any place to go. So just
and a lot of people in apartments who can't have big dogs who want
right.
small dogs.
Right. And a lot of people, as you know, retire here and they want a small dog as a companion. A lot of people are alone. So I started very small. I would bring two or three to my home, put up posters around, usually in vets' offices and good pet food places. And slowly it grew, and we got big enough to have a name and other volunteers, and now there are five people fostering. And we always have little dogs, mini purebreds, and a lot of little mixes available. We have an application process. We do ask for references. We do a home check because these dogs have lost their home, and we don't want them to lose their home again if we can prevent it.
You mean you actually go to their house and see if they have a fence and see if they
exactly.
have a dog door or whatever?
Exactly. And it gives us an opportunity to talk more intimately with the person looking at the dog or dogs to help make a good fit. Sometimes people will see a dog and they think it's cute, but it really isn't a fit for their family.
Right.
I've had people wanting, say, a Minpin or a Jack Russell, but they're gone all day and they don't have a yard the dog can go into. That's not a good fit because that dog needs a lot of exercise. But we
Jack Russells need exercise?
Oh, gee. We call them boing boings. But there are other little dogs that are perfectly happy to, you know, kind of rest on a pillow till mom or dad get home. So we try to make that match.
Where do you find the dogs that you rescue? How do they come to you, or how do you find them?
Good question. We get them from a lot of different areas. Because I've been doing this now for over 7 years, word has gotten around. So we take a lot of dogs from shelters around the state. But we also have veterinarians from around the state call. If someone has died or gone into assisted living, they don't have a place for their dog to go. During the call-up for Iraq, we took in a lot of dogs, most of whom we put into foster care so they would be there when their person got back. We've had our first casualty. We are now rehoming that dog. And there are a variety of reasons people will surrender a dog to us. And one is they get a dog because they think it's cute, but they don't know anything about dogs. And they don't know how to house train it, or it just wasn't what they were expecting. So we never ask a question. We just take the dog if it's healthy and fits into our program.
What are your criteria? I mean, if you have a dog that's not healthy, will you say, I'm sorry, we can't take this dog?
No. Generally, we have vets that work with us, and we will get a workup to see what its health needs are. If the health needs are extensive and the owner is willing to take care of that, then we will go ahead and take the dog, and they pay for the health care that it needs. And then when it's well, we can adopt it. We don't have a big bank account, so there's some things that we can't do.
We're talking to Marguerite Wood of Small Dog Rescue. Do you ever get dogs that are not adoptable?
We don't get them because we do temperament testing before getting them. That did happen early on. A dog would be cute, and we would say, sure, send it to us, and then we would find out it was a fear biter or just terrified of people in general. And it upped my personal population because they were sweet dogs, and I couldn't bear to put them down. So now we do temperament testing because there's a reality of how many dogs that we can take because we work from our homes.
Right. How do you find the foster parents for the dogs?
I actually have friends that are still my friends who have adopted from me and then seen that it was a good thing to help keep this going.
So this is Small Dog Rescue of Santa Fe, and we will talk to you in a few minutes about how people can get in touch with you and the process they have to go through if they want to adopt a dog. But let's turn for the moment to Bill Hutchison from the Santa Fe Animal Shelter. Hello.
How are you?
What's happening at the animal shelter?
Well, this, not really this week, but this, not this month anymore because it's August 1st, but July was our second anniversary in the new shelter. And it's weird for me to say that because I feel like we've just been talking about it.
Yeah,
really, it does just feel like yesterday. But we've been in there for 2 years, and I would attribute the rapid passage of time to the fact that we've been so incredibly busy since we hit the ground there. But we've been talking a lot about what it's meant to have been there for 2 years, and that the community has supported us for 2 years. It took 10 years to get this project off the ground. It took our former director, Kate Rendy, 10 years and the board to raise the $10.2 million to build this place. And after 2 years, you know, one of the questions we got a lot when we moved in was, yeah, this is all really nice, but what's it actually going to do? And I kind of think of the shelter as this enormous Swiss Army knife with a million little tools on it that we can all use for animal welfare. And after a couple of years, I think we've really got a pretty good handle on how to use that facility. And you'll see in the New Mexican in the coming weeks, we're going to put out a report in the paper to really let the community know what we've done over the last couple of years with their money and with this facility that they built for us. But it blows my mind. We've gotten to the point now where if we come up with a crazy idea to move some animals around, to help them find homes, to do what we can to help as many animals as we can in this community, we've got this giant Swiss Army knife that you can do it with. And that's been very, very exciting. Our transfer programs, our spay-neuter clinic in town, all these things that have come to pass that I couldn't have imagined even when we moved in there 2 years ago.
What are some of the blades that you want to talk about?
Let's call them tools.
The saw, the
hatchet. Blades we only use in the spay-neuter clinic. You know, the Traveling Tales program is one of my favorite programs, not just because it has a clever name, but there are a lot of rural shelters throughout this community that have a lot of trouble rehoming animals. Essentially what they have to do because they don't have the facility or the resources.
Did you just coin a new word again?
Did I? What did I say?
Rehoming?
No, rehoming is animal welfare lingo, which I probably shouldn't be using lingo on the air, but that's a...
Oh, it's okay.
It's a real fake word. Traveling Tales has allowed us to take these animals from these rural shelters where they maybe have a 15% live release rate and get them homes in our community where we have a much easier time finding homes than, say, Artesia or Roswell, or very, very small communities with a tremendous overpopulation program. We had a donor who recently bought us a cargo van so we can now transfer animals much easier between shelters. We're not only doing this in New Mexico, but we're even bringing animals up from San Miguel de Allende and Juarez, part of the Save a Mexican Mutt program. And we get a lot of this is sort of our version of small dog rescue. We get a lot of little dogs from Mexico. The primary difference between our dogs and Marguerite's dogs is that all the dogs we bring in speak only Spanish. So we have to do some language training as soon as they come into the shelter. You know, sit, stay, instead of, whatever the equivalent is in Spanish.
Well, actually, my dog, Honey, actually does understand quite a bit of Spanish because of some people who lived in my house for about a year.
Oh, that's perfect.
And she knows quieres caminar and comida.
And siéntese.
My dog understands muttering and swearing under my breath, but that's for a variety of different reasons.
Muttering.
I'm kind of coining another word there. So we've done that program, and then the spay, neuter, and wellness clinic, which we just opened up. That was really a dream come true. We needed something The veterinarians in this town are unbelievable. They're really, really fantastic vets, and they support shelters and sanctuaries and rescue groups like you wouldn't believe. But there's a whole vast array of folks in our community who need spay-neuter surgery and who need vaccinations at a cost they can afford. And that's the idea of this clinic. We don't want it to be competitive with the veterinarians, but now we've got this place where anybody can come in and for essentially cost, we don't need to make a profit, we just need to keep the place running. We can do these spay-neuters and these vaccinations, and it makes a huge, huge difference. Already we've seen a big change, and through the end of this month, through the end of August, through a $400,000 grant from the state legislature, anybody who receives any kind of state or federal assistance can get their dog or cat spayed or neutered for free. So you have all these veterinary clinics, including the Santa Fe Animal Shelter, throughout the state who are able to do this. And it's making a tremendous difference. I mean, free is a heck of a lot better even than our low prices already. So if you are on any kind of assistance and you have an unaltered dog or cat, now is the time. Jump on that bandwagon. The money, I believe, is only going to be there until the end of August. If there's any left, we'll extend it. But we want to do as many as we can. So, you know, that's 2 years. We went from a place where...
Let me ask you about that program for a second. Let's say a person who's on public assistance has a dog, and the dog doesn't have anything. It doesn't have shots. It doesn't have a license, and so on. Can it still get spayed and neutered and the whole nine yards?
It can still get spayed and neutered for free. I'm not 100% sure where we're at with the vaccinations at this point because the money has been shifted around. We've been able to move our deadlines back a number of times.
But they're not going to say you can't spay and neuter your dog because you don't have its shots yet.
Oh, no. Okay. No. No, the whole focus of this clinic is to do the greatest number of very, very safe, compassionate spays and neuters that we can. And what we're trying to do is combat overpopulation, and that's our primary focus. It has to be our primary focus.
All of this at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and we'll give the telephone number in a moment. Back to Marguerite Wood from Small Dog Rescue. You've been talking about... the question of foster homes and how you train somebody to be a foster home parent, foster dog mother or father.
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, most of the people who are doing fostering are experienced dog people. They have dogs and they know how to train dogs. And frankly, when you have as many dogs as I do, your social life kind of shrinks into the people who also love dogs because they can stand coming in your house and you can stand going in their house. And right now, all the people who are working with me have dogs of their own, have lengthy experience with it, have been through training, and so they train the dogs very well. And we have, you know, hilarious stories we share with each other with the dogs. But one of the wonderful things about having the small dog rescue and working out of our homes is we really get to know the dogs. We really have the opportunity to train them so that they are housebroken. They have a few manners before they leave. And some people, they're busy, they're working, they want to know what they're getting. We recently placed a little dog with a couple, and they're busy working, but they do work out of their home most of the time, and they called us and they said, "This is the smartest dog we've ever had." And he is smart, but he had the opportunity of coming.
He was fixing their printers and so on?
Just about.
I always say with small dogs, you never leave your car keys laying around.
No, and don't leave your computer on.
Or your credit cards.
That's right.
They call for pizzas.
That's yes. Why you have to have the dialy circular phone instead of the touchpad, the touch tone phone.
Yeah, or really small numbers because their paws just...
Well, and aside, I have a cat that can turn on the computer. And I just lay in wait watching to see
you
why.
You have a cat?
Cat that... I have two cats. They're 20.
They get along with your dogs?
Sort of. I
wish our listeners could have seen the look on Marguerite's face when Mary Charlotte. It was a lot like the look of a small child when they take a big bite of a really sour lemon.
Yeah. But this, my female cat's very smart, and she can turn the computer on, and she likes to lie down on top of it because it's warm. She can also turn the answering machine on and off, and so finally I put a big heavy cape cover over it because it was always off when I wanted it on. But back to the dogs, we do spend a lot of time training them and getting them ready for their homes, and that's the difference. I'm a volunteer at the shelter, and there's limit to what any shelter can do because of manpower and the number of dogs that come in. And I'm not saying one against the other, because I send people to our shelters all the time. We don't always have what people are looking for. We don't always have a lot of dogs. They come and go. Another thing I would like to say real quickly, if I may, is our senior program. We get older dogs, and they're wonderful. A lot often people have died, and they didn't make plans for their little dogs, and the vets call or a family member call. Day before yesterday, I placed a 12-year-old dog with an older couple who had lost their dog. And these folks are in their 80s, and they really wanted another dog, and they love this dog. And they've asked us to bring another one so that that little dog can have a companion dog.
I think it's it highlights not only the importance of adoption, but the importance of, in your will, and we talked about this with Ulla Peterson last week, making provisions for your animals as well as your house and other assets.
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't think about this, or maybe assume that a family member will take care of it. But I'll quote a situation that Bill and I both worked in several years ago. Bill, you may remember, a lady died, and she had several dachshunds, one of whom was in a wheelchair. And the other, the mobile dogs got adopted really quickly. I also do dachshund rescue, and so we were making plans and working because we were very concerned about this very sweet little dog in a wheelchair, and a neighbor heard the woman had died, came over and got the dog. So nice things happen. But older dogs, particularly in shelters, older dogs, their chances are not as good. So for the small dog, we opened up our senior program.
And I have to say, an older dog, even with the attendant health problems, can be, as my little dog Dugan was, who graced my life for 2 years, the most incredible gift, because they're mellow and they're very grateful and very loving.
They are. And, you know, in the will thing, it's good to leave some money for veterinary care for your dog, particularly if it's up in years.
Now, why do you have a separate dachshund rescue from small dog rescue? Dachshunds being an example of small dogs.
Right. I have dachshunds, and I was with dachshund rescue for years before I started small dog rescue. So it's a separate nonprofit. It's statewide. We have a website, and we place specifically dachshunds. We also have cared for dachshunds that have been abused physically so that we can rehabilitate them and get them back on their feet. We've provided monies for back surgery and the chairs and get them up and going and then get them adopted. But we also have young ones. As you know, I have a 2-month-old one in my car.
Whom we will look at after the program is over today, ladies and gentlemen.
We'll hold him up to the microphone.
We'll hold him up to the microphone so everyone can see the masses of cuteness streaming forth.
You know, I was just sitting here listening and thinking about how important it is for all these animal organizations in this community to work together. And Marguerite is very kind about the shelter, and certainly over the years we have worked together a lot. And I think the thing that's most laudable about that is that it's very easy to, because there are so many different philosophies in animal welfare and so many different approaches to how you do animal welfare, that it can be very easy to take those philosophical approaches and use them as a, or find them as a way to keep yourself apart from other animal welfare organizations. And in the long run, that doesn't help animals. It helps the very few that you keep insulated from the rest of the world. But organizations like Small Dog Rescue and the many, many sanctuaries and rescue groups in Santa Fe and the two shelters of northern New Mexico all working together, we're seeing a huge difference already. And it's exciting. It's stunning how much more of a difference you can make. And this dialogue that you're seeing here, I think, is a great example of that.
How do you measure progress? I mean, you are with an organization that has many tools. Is one of those tools being able to actually statistically measure?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the best tools we ever got, we bought at the end of 2003 in late December, and it was a very expensive piece of software that shelters can use to manage the animals that come through there. And one of the things that we've been able to do is take a really good statistical snapshot. You know, I firmly believe that our first priority has to be the individual animals, each individual animal that we have at the shelter. But the second thing we need to do is address the needs of this community. And by taking these statistical pictures, X number of dogs from the come from the county versus the city that are X percentage of this breed, and a certain percentage of those are unaltered. So we can say, for example, that we know that of all the dog breeds, 20% of the animals that we get in are pits or pit mixes, and we're able to adopt out 5% of those. So all of a sudden, we see an issue we can address. That's what got us in gear to do our pit stop, free pit spay-neuter day. If you can take these pictures, if you really know the needs of the community, you can start. It's really hard to get ahead of overpopulation, but you can start doing it. We figure we'd need to spay and neuter about 30,000 animals in a 12-month period to really get ahead of overpopulation in northern New Mexico. And then you'd have to do ongoing maintenance. But all these little tiny pieces that we can look at, all these little bits of numbers and information show us that, in fact, we are being effective, that the shelters, the rescue groups, the sanctuaries, all these different organizations are actually making a difference. If you talk to somebody who's been in Santa Fe for many, many years and ask them how animals are treated here now versus 10 and 20 and 50 and 100 years ago, then you get a very, very different picture, and you see that very slowly and societally we're making a change on behalf of our best friends.
You are you're an organization that works in Santa Fe County, but a lot of the animals come from other parts of the state.
We're a northern New Mexico nonprofit, but our intention, our mission, and our goal, which we're succeeding in, is to be a resource for the whole state. Lisa Geip, who's our behavior manager and in charge of our transfer program, gets calls from all over New Mexico. She gets calls from Oklahoma and Arizona. We bring in the dogs from Mexico. For us to have this here, I mean, Santa Fe is, for a small town of about 70,000 people, somehow we're really finding a way to lead animal welfare in this state. And I think what you see, the reason we can do that are groups like Marguerite and other smaller groups and the large shelters all really pledging themselves to making that difference. And you have good people who are not just patting themselves on the back and saying, we do good things for animals.
They're not just patting their dogs on the back.
Exactly. Not just patting the dogs or themselves or their neighbor or the chair, but really doing something, pushing themselves all the time to do as much as possible for animals within the obviously limited resources that all of us have.
We're running out of time, but Marguerite Wood.
Just very briefly, I've worked with animal organizations in other states, and I want to follow up with Bill. There is less political divisiveness within the group, particularly in Santa Fe. We all strive to work together. We contact each other by email all the time. We alert each other to dogs in need. Can you help? Whether it fits in our category or not, we all pitch in to help. And that's unusual. These sorts of organizations can have their own political agenda, and it just washed out here.
Mm-hmm. How do people get in touch with you, Marguerite, if they would like to talk to you about small dogs?
My phone number is 438-3749. That's 438-3749.
And if anybody hears anything on this show that they would like to, that they've forgotten the number or couldn't write it down because they were driving, just send me an email at radiocafe@ksfr.org. And people have been starting to do that, and it's great, and we are able to pass on the information. Bill Hutchison, how do people get in touch with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society?
You can call us up at 983-4309. We're at 100 Caja del Rio Road off of 599. And as always, all of our adoptable and lost animals are on the web at sfhumanesociety.org.
Bill Hutchison and Marguerite Wood, thank you so much for being with us this first Wednesday of every month, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe animal segment. We won't call it a dog segment.
Anyway, thanks, Mary Charlotte.
And we will see you soon.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we'll be talking about the Robert Frank Film Festival. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Darius Himes. He is the editor of Photo Eye, a quarterly magazine devoted to photography books, and a founding member of Radius Books here in Santa Fe, and himself a photographer. And we're here to talk about the Robert Frank Film Festival, which is this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Film Center on St. Michael's Drive. Welcome, Darius.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. How are you?
Good. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Robert Frank, a photographer, filmmaker, Swiss, born in 1924. What do you know about his life? What's his claim to fame, especially where films are concerned?
Well, I'd actually start before films are concerned. His real claim to fame and his fame in the photography community has to do with his major project that was funded by a Guggenheim, which produced the book called The Americans. It's a classic of road trip photography, initially published in France in 58 and then published in an American edition in 1959. And it's one of those books and one of those bodies of work that so many photographers have cited as an inspiration and as a real classic of American photography. So his work really starts there in terms of his fame in the photography community. But shortly after that, he moves into filmmaking as another venue. And, you know, one of the things that is most interesting about Frank is that he becomes wrapped up with people like Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, who then are obviously part of the Beat Generation. And quickly after The Americans comes out, he then goes on to make a couple of films like, for instance, The Sin of Jesus, which was produced in 1960 and is one of the films that's being screened.
It's interesting, with his work, The Americans, he's been compared to de Tocqueville, who wrote Democracy in America, as somebody who took an outsider's perspective on America. First, I guess he was really entranced with this country and then started to see the seamy underbelly.
Yeah, I mean, he had been working in New York as an editorial photographer. He was actually included in the famous Museum of Modern Art show called The Family of Man, which was curated by Steichen. And so he had been working in journalism, and as you said, he really became a bit disenchanted with, more I would say, disenchanted with how America was being portrayed, and rather set out to really portray what he saw as the true America. And in that sense, I like that connection with de Tocqueville in terms of really trying to present a much more realistic view. And his work was criticized as being depressing and just not upbeat at all, very much a critical view. And yet, to be honest, I think that there's a theme that runs throughout Frank's work, which is a real search for truth and a search for reality, rather than hiding behind the masks that either a country or an artist or, you know, individuals hide behind. And that's a theme that runs throughout both his photography and his films.
The earliest film that I've seen, called Pull My Daisy, is narrated by Jack Kerouac and has a star-studded cast with Allen Ginsberg and Gregory Corso and some of these other folks.
Right, right.
And it's kind of a story and kind of a rambling I don't know what.
Yeah, it's very much of the Beat Generation style. I mean, some of the some of the things that characterize the Beats is that they were all about spontaneity and about visceral engagements and visceral engagement with gritty situations. You know, and one of the things, this actually comes up in Paper Route again, where it seems, both of those movies seem so completely unchoreographed and chaotic, and yet what, in doing some research, the reality is that they were very choreographed. And so that's a fascinating, it's this balance between control and chaos, and it kind of brings up it allows for a level of spontaneity.
We're talking to Darius Himes about the Robert Frank Film Festival, and that's this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 7 o'clock. Now, he made a film about the Rolling Stones, which the Rolling Stones hated, where it's not screening right now because the Rolling Stones tried to sue him and get it not shown, and there was a kind of compromise agreement where it gets to be shown only 5 times a year, and Robert Frank has to be there. Have you ever seen this movie?
I haven't, no.
I'm dying to see this movie now.
It was essentially a documentary of their 1972 tour, right? And lots of infamous things happened and illegal things happened. But the reality of the reality of it now is that as you mentioned, it can't be shown unless Frank is present, and that's one of the reasons that we're not showing it.
But, is there a provision after his death? I mean, he's in his 80s now.
I have no idea. And, you know, the impetus behind this entire film festival is the fact that Steidl Publishers, based in Germany, who's a fantastic, they're a fantastic art book publisher, has undertaken what they're calling the Robert Frank Publishing Program. And over the next 5 years, they are reprinting and releasing all of his previous books as well as new books, and they're going back and remastering all of his films and releasing them in two complete volumes. So that movie will be included in, you'll be able to purchase that movie as part of the the Frank DVD sets. They're not they're essentially being produced right now. They're not completely available, but that's a fascinating fact that the movie is eventually going to be, you'll be able to purchase it. So
it's interesting to think about. I watched, in preparation for this rather brief interview, I watched 7 of these movies, and it's not easy to watch these movies. I mean, they're called, you'd call something like this experimental film, and I was thinking about the sort of science metaphor implied when you say experimental, and when you're doing an experiment, you're trying to find out what's true, and you're trying to find out what's real, but it just goes on and on. It's like they're sort of experimenting without goal or end, and it sort of becomes its own aesthetic.
It does, and it's actually, you know, one of the things that I would want to convey to anybody that's coming to the film festival is that the theme for me...
Come at your own risk.
Come at your own risk, and also be aware that, you know, there is obviously this this style of chaos, searching, almost like I would say, searching for truth amidst the chaos, and that is very much reflected. You know, many of the films are handheld. There's really good sound involved. Like one of the last movies that I watched last night, also in going through things, was Paper Route, which essentially is a film that follows... Robert Frank has been living in both Nova Scotia and then New York City off and on for the last 30 years. And in Nova Scotia, he follows a man on a, you know, pre-dawn paper route that travels all around this community in the wintertime. And it's fascinating because...
You're sitting in the car. The filmmaker is holding the camera, pointing it at the driver, who's driving around, just blathering.
Just blathering, and on a certain level has no idea who Robert Frank is in
right.
terms of, you know, notoriety in the photography community. And yet there's this wonderful moment where the driver describes... He says, now we've made this circle, you know, describing the circle that they've just driven. And again, you're starting at, I think they started at like 4 in the morning or something, and it's dark and it's slowly becoming more and more light. And Frank says to him, he says, after he makes this comment about driving this circle, he says, you're right, we're all making this circle. And it's this, you know, again, it's this idea of this traveling, this circle of birth to death, of searching from, you know, going from ignorance to knowledge. It really becomes this metaphor, and you can, or at least I felt like I could hear it in Frank's voice as he queried the driver, who didn't pick up on the metaphor at all and just sort of laughed it off. But there's this, you know, the landscape of Nova Scotia being this seemingly, you know, barren, snow-swept landscape really provides a perfect setting for that kind of inquiry about search for truth.
What kind of headspace do you think that people need to put themselves in? Because if you're expecting a narrative movie, you're going to be not only disappointed, but probably pretty antsy.
Yeah, definitely. One of the only movies that is narrative-driven is The Sin of Jesus, which is being screened on Friday night, I think.
Which is based on an Isaac Babel short story.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the movies that really made me think, you know what, Frank knows what he's doing. It's like beautifully choreographed, the photography is amazing, the lighting is amazing, and yet all of the other movies are very much, you know, chaotic and handheld and seemingly no script involved. And you really have to, I think, put yourself into the mindset of, again, so much of his films, I think, speak about what lies behind the quote script, lies behind this mask of acting, of play acting in our lives, and I think he's trying to get behind that in all of those circumstances. So you have to really be waiting for and watching for these moments where something real pokes through.
And it's really, I mean, with the exception of the movie that you just mentioned, The Sin of Jesus, in most of the movies, it's sort of like watching a field and waiting for a prairie dog to poke its head out of the...
That's a great description. It's true.
Yeah. Well, listen, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but Darius Himes, I want to thank you for being here. Anything else you want to say about Robert Frank before we go?
I would just encourage everybody that feels like they have been inspired by Frank's The Americans, or anybody that feels like they really know Frank and would like to know Frank more, to really come and explore these. I mean, these films go from...
There's probably people who know his photography and have never seen his filmmaking.
Yeah, exactly. The films that are being screened go from like 1960 all the way up until 2002. Paper Route was filmed in 2002. So they span this entire 40-year career. And it really will give you a much deeper insight into what he's been doing. He's known for being a recluse, and the fact that we're bringing all of these films together at one time is really an amazing opportunity for everybody.
Darius Himes, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Darius Himes is editor of Photo Eye and founding member of Radius Books. He's a photographer. He's been talking to us about the Robert Frank Film Festival, which is this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Film Center on St. Michael's Drive. We're going to take another brief break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to two women dancing and a cellist. Well, they're not going to be dancing on the air, but stay tuned. I would like now to welcome two women dancing, Julie Brett Adams and Kate Eberle, and Timothée Marcel, who is the cellist for the work that's coming up this weekend and next weekend, called The Bach Project. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thanks for having us. Bonjour, Marie-Charlotte.
Bonjour. This is a very interesting project that you've taken on. You're using music from the Bach Solo Cello Suites. How did you choose the Bach Solo Cello?
Well, I've been in love with the music for about 10 years and wanting to explore more of it with choreography. And Timo has been listening to the cello suites probably since he was in the womb of his mother and playing them since he was very young.
Is your mother a cellist?
My father is a cellist, but my mother is a music lover.
And so you grew up in a very musical family hearing this all your life?
Completely, and not only the Bach suites, but music in general. But my father played for my mother the Bach suites, and he played the Bach suites a lot in concerts, and so, yes, I heard the suites since I was really a baby.
And I'm in my infancy in terms of my knowledge and appreciation of the suites, but it's been an incredible experience for me to be introduced to this music, both through Julie's passion and, of course, Timo's incredible, beautiful playing. And I'm a convert now, so I am now. So we each bring a really different perspective to the music. And
how did you go about doing the choreography? Were you working with Timothée from the beginning? Were you working with discs?
Well, because Timo lives in Paris, unfortunately, we couldn't go to Paris to rehearse with him. Dragged. Kate and I have been working for about a year on our own. We did have a recording of Timo's interpretation of the score once we created a score together, choosing different movements from different suites.
And so what was that process like? What were you looking for? How did you interact with the music during that process of forming the choreography?
Well, we each came, as Julie said, from a pretty different perspective. For me, to be able to appreciate Bach's complex and all at once simple music and to interpret that movement-wise was really a special and interesting challenge for me. And in terms of how we created the movement, it's just Julie was really informed from a soulful, emotional place and, my kind of newness to it. It just all came together in an interesting way.
Our process, no matter what project we're working on, is a deep collaboration. Mm-hmm. So it will be literally, I'll bring a few movements, and then Kate will see that, and she'll bring something else, and we'll create a phrase, and we'll see how the phrase drops into the music, and it just sort of rolls along. Not to say that it was an easy process. It was rather intimidating to create dance to such majestic music.
I don't know if there's an answer to this question because dance is such a nonverbal medium, but what emotions did the music bring out in you that you were trying to express in the dance?
I would say that we look to explore each movement with a different emotion or a different theme.
And what were some of those emotions?
For example, Prelude to the First, which is, of course, is the most popular and well-known of the Sweets, movements of the Sweets, is a very joyful, celebratory piece of music, and yet it's so amazingly well composed and tight that it was really challenging to do anything that made any sense to it because it's so complete in and of itself. So we worked really hard, did a lot of throw this out, find something else. No, this isn't, as we say, cooked yet. We got to keep cooking here.
Interesting, using a cooking metaphor. The project is called Two Women Dancing, the Bach Project, and it is being performed in 5 performances in Body, which is right close to the Santa Fe Baking Company, in their studio there, this Saturday and Sunday, and the next weekend, Saturday and Sunday. We'll give the times at the end of the program. When you're in rehearsal, which I went to yesterday, Timothée is really almost a third dancer in the piece.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What's that like for you?
I really see myself as a dancer too. So I'm really, I hope, to play the cello, to play the instrument is really physical, and it has to be, to me, it has to be beautiful visually. You know, when you see a musician, if the movement is beautiful to see, it's right, you know, that means it's a good movement.
when you're playing the cello and you're not on stage as a dancer, that doesn't happen very often, you're a classical musician, do you still think about your movement? Do you still think about what the audience sees?
Completely.
Really?
It's so important. It's so important. The visual part is extremely important. Obviously, the music, the soul, the visual part, because you can listen to a CD and you will hear the beautiful music, but if you go to the concert you want to experiment something else.
And so do you add drama that you might not put in otherwise because there's an audience there?
Yes, completely. And also I would like to say something about the mood of the Sweets, because you were talking before about the different moods and how could we express that? How do we express that? You know, those Sweets are really interesting to me because there is 6 Sweets, and to me in those 6 Sweets there is all the moods that a human being has in general. There is all the moods. There is, childhood, naivete. There is death, there is joy. In the 3rd Suite, for example, Bach is really in a good mood. You know, you feel it. It's just that. And there is drama, there is emotion, there is love, there is, like, it's hard to express with words, but to me there is really all the moods.
And it's interesting that in this you've chosen, I don't know who of you made the musical selections, but you're working with pieces from three different cello suites.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we created the score together, partly, of course, making sure that we were choosing movements that Timo felt comfortable playing and in an order that was acceptable to him as a musician. But we also, of course, needed to choose movements that, as dancers, we felt motivated to choreograph.
Now, what has been Timothée's role? I want to hear from both from the dancer's perspective and the musician's perspective in creating the dance and creating what people see on stage.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, as we said earlier, Kate and I have worked mostly without Timo, but we really did want to make this a trio, not two women dancing with some guy off on the side playing the cello for us. So we asked him from the beginning, what do you think of this? Does this work for you? Does it work that you're seated here? And he would say, well, no, I can't really see you. I need to be like this. Or he would just say, that choreography doesn't work for me, which at times was a bit challenging. But all in all, it was really the best way to do it because it affected us, it challenged us, and I think made it a better work.
Right. And Timo, when we first saw Timo play in a concert, I know I was really struck by his physicality. I mean, he really is a dancer when he's moving.
Very expressive.
It's, Yeah, and it's it embodies a complete physicality as well as that emotional, you know, component that's so beautiful to watch. And so for us to not only dance, but to ask him, what movement would you be comfortable adding in addition to what also comes naturally to you as a player? So we've put some choreography on Timo, too, which has been
tiny bit
fun and interesting for all of us.
Thank you very much, Kate. And, you know, it's the same thing for me. It's an incredible pleasure to see you. And I have seen Julie and Kate dancing before this project, obviously. And also, it's really interesting to notice that those suites are dances. It's the Baroque dance, you know, like the Baroque suites. It's, you know, an Allemande, the courante,
right,
you know,
exactly.
The Maybe French dances, German dances, right. Everything. So it, to me, it's made to be danced, I think, even if we don't know if at Bach times, I mean, they did it. We absolutely don't know about that.
Did you study Baroque dance at all in preparation
no,
for this?
No, we have zero. We decided
knowledge of that.
We took it way out of the traditional into a much more contemporary
this is
present
what you would call modern dance.
Yes,
that's your influence.
Right.
Who are your greatest choreographic influences?
Oh, that's a hard question.
That is
to
a
answer.
Hard question.
I think, well, Mark Morris did an interesting collaboration with Yo-Yo Ma with one of the suites, which we watched and were quite inspired by. I don't think necessarily specifically movement-wise, but just the whole embodiment of the suites in a contemporary way was quite inspiring for me.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. Probably with respect to this project, that was the most informative, if not an actual influence.
Right.
And the two of you have been working together for how long?
Since
many years.
Since 2004.
Since 2004. So do you plan to go on indefinitely?
Oh, yes. As long as
body willing.
Bodies can do it, we're going for it.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the, I suppose that dancers, more than any other artist, are fighting time.
Yeah.
That is true.
Yeah. What's that like for you? I mean, I imagine that, you know, the two of you have been dancing for over 20 years, probably 30 years each since you were children. What is gained and what is lost as you get older as a dancer?
Well, obviously, the body in some ways is not as agile, but you deepen your emotional and theatrical, dramatic capacities because you have more to draw on from your years of experience living and suffering.
Well, the time has come. It's just a couple of minutes before 9 o'clock. I want to thank you all for being here. Julie Brett Adams, Kate Eberle, and Timothée Marcel, who is the cellist in the Bach Project, Two Women Dancing. And there are 5 performances at Body on August 4th and 5th, and then August 11th and 12th. For more information, you can call Body at 986-0362. You can go to bodyofsantafe.com. And that's it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And, oh, by the way, I want to let people know that we are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. Let's see. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features, and I have it out here.
Keep looking.
Here it is. He told me not to misplace it today. Good Morning Jazz presents the monthly Women of Jazz show, including an interview with Israeli-born clarinetist Anat Cohen, and Giants of Jazz features trumpet legend Freddie Hubbard. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta la vista. Ciao.